You're listening to All Things Cage at Wavefarm's WGXC 90.7 FM radio for open ears. I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, director of the John Cage Trust, and my guest this week is 40-year-old music historian Brent Reedy, who was recently named director of the research libraries of the New York Public Library. This put him at the helm of four vast public research centers: the Stephen A. Schwartzman Building, the Library for the Performing Arts at Lincoln Center, the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture, and the Yoseloff Business Center, with hundreds of employees and which collectively have roughly 47 million items in their collections. John Cage's music manuscript collection is a jewel within the holdings of the Performing Arts Library, of course, which Reedy visits weekly. As he told Dan Bilewski, who wrote the news of his appointment in the New York Times on December 29, 2022, these intermittent pilgrimages to visit with John Cage help him to de-stress. In the midst of what is surely an intense time, Reedy agreed to do a program, me, Kuhn, for All Things Cage. As you'll hear, the two have known each other for years, their first encounter taking place while Reedy was an undergraduate student at Dartmouth College, where, under the tutelage of such eminent musician teachers as Larry Polansky, he first fell in love with Cage's work. As Bilewski notes, Reedy has long been an ardent supporter of federal funding for the arts. During the Trump administration, he criticized its attempt to eliminate the NEA, citing President John F. Kennedy's assertion that artistic freedom was essential to nourish American culture. After earning his BA from Dartmouth, Reedy continued his exploration of national cultural policy under the Kennedy administration during graduate studies at Indiana University, where he earned his PhD, which will be the subject of an upcoming book. Reedy began his tenure at NYPL in 2017 as deputy director and later interim executive director of the Library for the Performing Arts. From 2019 to 2022, he led the digital research team responsible for digitization and digital preservation. Under his leadership, the library has doubled its digital storage and launched a digitization strategy focused on diversity, equity, and inclusion. Not insignificantly, he's also renegotiated the library's contract with Google to increase access to hundreds of thousands of digitized books. Reedy is deeply committed to the public the library serves. As he noted in his interview with Bilewski, attendance at the research libraries was 30% below the average attendance before the pandemic and had not yet returned to pre-pandemic levels, a challenge facing cultural institutions nationwide. Now, in 2023, just months into his new position, continued digitization remains a priority, in his view, something that had become even more imperative during the coronavirus pandemic as users gravitated online. So welcome to All Things Cage, Brent. It's really great to see you after so long.
It's been more than a decade.
I know, it's true. I would recognize you anywhere, though. That's the funny thing about this.
So one of my, I think, most embarrassing things, but maybe proudest thing is I'm 6'8". I used to lie and tell people I was 6'9", or I'd say I used to, you know, fudge the truth slightly, because when I was first getting into music history research and I was focusing so much on Cage, if I were 6'9", that would make me 4'33".
That's very cute. That's very cute. But you're really not 6'9", are you?
Six feet, 8 inches. So
you
I wish
you really are 6'8". Wow. Well, are you married? Do you have a partner?
A very normal height, Rachel. Rachel.
Yeah. She's normal, like 5'6", 5'7".
Exactly. Yes. Sadly, I'm not 4'33", but.
Well,
I'm,
you're close.
Close.
You're four. No, let's see. Well, we'll do the math after. I want to talk to you about so many things, but our audience may not know who you are. So I thought maybe if you'd be willing, I definitely want to talk about your new big job, which is took the world by storm. Brent Reedy, as I'm going to say in your introduction, will have said by the time the audience is listening to this, that you took the world by storm and you even made the New York Times. They did a piece about you and it was thrilling. It was really thrilling. And your job looked, in its description, looked so demanding that I hesitated to call you and ask you if you wanted to do a radio program with me, because I just felt so guilty because you're managing countless people and countless materials and countless projects. And you're just, what are you, 20?
I'm not that young, but I am relatively young, especially for the role, for sure.
Yeah. So I do want to talk about that. But wondered if we could start by your telling me again about the trajectory of your career with regard to Cage, since this is all things Cage, after all. Absolutely. And you are now shepherding the manuscript collection, so you haven't really left Cage by being at NYPL. That will also give our audience some sense of the trajectory of our relationship, because we've known each other throughout much of it because of John Cage. So how did we meet? Do you remember? What were you doing when we met?
So I think we might have first met when I was in grad school and was publishing an essay in American music. This is when Michael Hicks was the editor of it.
Uh-huh.
I think I needed permission, or I forget what exactly, how the connection was made. But I think that's how the connection was made. And if I believe my memory, I think Larry Polansky might have connected us in the first place.
Michael Hicks is the Cowell person, right? He became sort of famous by writing the article about Cowell's incarceration.
Yeah, so to answer your question, so I went to college thinking I was going to be an engineer, and I just started dabbling in composing music and playing piano. I only started when I think I was in the seventh grade. Came to it very late. No one in my family that I knew really had much of a background in music, besides, you know, one uncle who didn't do it professionally but could pick up a guitar. I quickly was convinced to drop my engineering degree and pursue my passions full time by one of the composers who was there. I went to Dartmouth College, and there's just a whole group of composers that were New York School adjacent or in this vicinity that nurtured me along the way. So I got to spend my time with Larry Polansky and Charles Dodge and John Appleton.
This is when you were an undergrad, right? Where were you, Dartmouth?
Dartmouth, yeah. And I knew Christian Wolf a bit there too, though he had retired since then, but he was still around the department. He was probably in the music library more than I was listening to something. But I think I first encountered Cage in a class that Larry Polansky taught, a seminar, in which I think it was a John Cage and Ruth Crawford Seeger doubleheader historic.
Was this when Larry was doing the CDs? I forget, Frog Peak, right? Frog Peak?
Yeah. And I think one of the very first classes, Larry took us without much instruction and saying why he was doing it. It might have even been the first day of class. He just walked in, gestured to us that we were all going to be quiet, and took us on a 40-minute walk around campus and had us just listen to different rooms and space.
Wow, nice.
And then we spent an hour talking about it when we got back, and I was sort of taken by it. So I ended up falling in love with Cage's music. I originally wanted to be a composer, and then I got turned on to music history by a music history professor at Dartmouth who's still a close friend and mentor, Steve Swain. He's, wrote the big book on Sondheim and on that side of the camp, and Will Schumann and others. But I got turned on to music history, and so I ended up going to Indiana University to get a PhD in music history, and wanted to focus exclusively on 20th century American music.
Me too. Not IU, but UCLA, but same thing.
Yeah.
Wait, so anybody in your family who's an engineer? I mean, why engineering?
I was very good at math, and that was when I was trying to figure out what to do, was something, suggested by people and thought it would make sense. And it just seemed certainly would be a good profession, I guess.
Your parents must have been pleased at that idea.
Earlier on, because I always did love math, and both my parents worked as insurance agents, just sort of like almost like a Ives connection, sort of.
I was going to say, they're in good company in your world.
Exactly. Actually, I wanted to be an actuarial, and then I got turned on to accounting.
I see. I don't think I've ever heard anyone say that.
I found one other person who does, but it's not a thing most people aspire towards. So yeah, I went to get my degree in music history and was focused on 20th century American music. I was very lucky to have a number of really great professors in graduate school, but most strongly in my research area is Peter Burkholder, who of course is one of the most important musicologists focused on 20th century American music, and Phil Ford as well as my closest mentors when it comes to my subject area.
I had to tell you a very funny story, very short. And that was when we were looking for a home for the manuscript collection. We started with the Soccer Foundation in Basel, in Switzerland. And I was there for a few days and I was perusing and meeting everybody and talking. And as you well know, it ended up not going there. But the story will kind of suggest to you why it ended up not going there. And we all went out to lunch and it was me and, 20 Adonises, blonde, blue-eyed Adonises from Switzerland and Germany and that area. And I was sitting next to this fellow, and we got to talking about our own academic lives. And he asked me what my academic subject was for my PhD. And I said, John Cage, of course. And I said, and you? And he said, Charles Ives, to which I got really excited. And I said, that's so interesting that you and I, had our subjects were these really important American composers. How interesting. And he said to me, he put down his fork and he said, somewhat dismissively, you're not suggesting that John Cage is on par with Charles Ives, are you? I said, well, yeah, I guess I was,
Not surprising, the territory battles there somewhat.
Yeah. So that was how the manuscript collection really ended up at NYPL because I came home really depressed. Like, now what?
Glad that faux pas happened. That's great. Well, and
And
actually, my first archival visit, when you're a grad student in music history, eventually you make your first journey to some archive somewhere to do primary research. And I was working on an article, and I went to Northwestern, where of course all the letters and correspondence are. And that was my first time digging through boxes, was digging through all of those. And it was a,
interesting. That's a huge collection.
yeah,
It's
I did not schedule nearly enough days to go through it.
right.
But I dipped my toes in and found some good things for something I was writing.
Yeah, it's a very one can get lost in that collection. It's so massive and it's so beautiful and it's so engaging. The way that they keep it, that they put, the childhood memorabilia kind of materials are together and all of that. I went to all of the archives right after we started the Cage Trust, really to just find out what they were all about and what they were doing and what their engagement was. And Northwestern was pretty special.
So from there, I ended up right after graduate school, not finishing my exams or dissertation right away. I got involved with some charity efforts post Katrina in New Orleans, put on concerts to raise money to relocate musicians who had left the city because of the flood. And I ended up moving to New York City and doing some work with some small and then larger jazz not-for-profits in the city, eventually getting a job at Jazz at Lincoln Center, working with them to help them on social media of all things, of which I'm not
When
an
was this? What year was this roughly, Brent? Just roughly.
08, maybe
Okay.
seven.
Okay. So 15 years ago-ish.
Yeah. And I because of that work, which was, to be honest, sort of just trying to earn a dollar and figure out what I'm doing and to raise some money for a good cause, I got to know the director of Jazz at Lincoln Center, who had in 1990 started a management consulting firm that focused just on cultural organizations, on
This is
symphonies.
EAI, right?
AEA. Yes, close enough, yeah.
No, what is it? Really, what is it? I say that with some embarrassment because I sit on the board of the Merce Cunningham Trust, and we are at present doing workshops with these people about the future of the Cunningham Trust and our work and what we're doing and thinking about. When I read that about in your bio, I thought, oh, that's so funny.
Ken Tabachnik, the executive director there,
Yes, of course.
with AEA a bit with me on a few projects. That's how I got to know him in the first place.
Interesting, interesting. Oh, I'll alert him to this program. He'll be
Yeah, we
interested in
did a big
hearing you.
project for the Boston Symphony Orchestra together, among others.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a company that does strategic plans and business plans for museums and symphonies and governments and others. I, to be honest, didn't know this kind of work existed. I was alerted to it by getting to know the person who had founded the company. And he was executive director at Jazz at Lincoln Center, but the company was still running without him.
Uh-huh. And
there was need for a researcher on a couple of projects, and he asked if I'd be interested. So I ended up joining for a project or two and quickly becoming enamored with what kind of felt like professional graduate school work. You spend 6 months with an organization, you try to figure out everything about that organization, crunch the data, look at the field, look at trends, talk to everyone who works there and the trustees and others, and come up with
exactly
solutions and ideas and help them figure out how to enact them. And so I stayed there for almost a decade.
Really? Wow, good for you.
Worked on 70 projects across a couple dozen countries and in a few continents. And as a music nerd, got to work with some of the greatest music organizations that I admire.
Give me five. Tell me five.
Sure. Boston Symphony Orchestra, the New York Philharmonic, the Cleveland Orchestra, and then Houston Grand Opera. But the one that topped it all, not that I'm picking favorites, but we worked with the Kronos String Quartet on there. And working with Janet and everyone was...
Yes, they're great, aren't they? Yeah. You know, every single one of those organizations has had relationship with Cage. Every single one. Isn't that nice?
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, they say don't meet your idols because they'll disappoint you. But it was never the case, actually. Mostly always encountered sort of kindness and genius along the way. And so that work was truly unexpected and truly very exciting. But going back to how we started this conversation, as a 6'8" music historian, flying around the world over and over for work, eventually lost its charm.
Yeah, no, I know. I went through that in Cage's centennial year, and I thought it was going to kill me.
Yeah.
France alone 8 times.
Back eventually. So I started looking for a place where I could, you know, take my music history interest and background, but my experience as someone who was working on the management side of arts not-for-profits, and combine it in a place, and most importantly, go somewhere where I could see the change through and have to stay for the impact of the work, and not just come up with a great plan then run away and leave people to do the work in my wake.
I like that. I like that. It's sort of like when you it's not so different from my job in the sense that somebody wants to do a festival or they want to do something and I guide them, but I'm not really part of it. And every once in a while, somebody says, no, you come here for a couple of months and do this with us, you know, it's thrilling.
There's a beauty to being arm's length and removed in some ways, but sometimes it can be a bit frustrating.
Yeah, I agree. It was kind of a revelation, but the first time it happened was with Michael Tilson Thomas and New World Symphony. And, I got to start at the bottom with it and applaud from the audience weeks later. You know, it was really lovely. It was really, really lovely.
Yeah, I had some of those moments too. I mean, one that just occurred a few years ago, I think I'm gonna forget the date they opened. And I know it was in the last 3 years, but I spent over a decade working with the leadership of the Irish Art Center in New York.
I just met them like a month ago, 6 weeks ago.
Yeah, they were in a small facility, and they moved around the corner, and they went from a 100-something seat theater to this beautiful, triple their capacity, new professional space, amazing lobby, amazing facility, amazing education space. And so we were there from the very beginning in helping them figure out what they would need out of a new space, how big it should be, what their programming might look like, what their education might look like. And to see that space after a decade, you know, be successfully built, the fundraising have it open, and to go to opening night was very satisfying.
Yeah, I can imagine. I can only imagine.
I built the spreadsheet. I did nothing else, but
that's okay. Somebody cares about that. Somebody cares about that deeply.
Yeah, the executive director
I often say that, you know, that you were talking about, you know, working with inspired people and dedicated people and on these projects with AEA. I've always find myself really defending people in the nonprofit culture sector of nonprofit world, that if I were to start a business tomorrow, I would look for employees from that domain because they know how to get things done with not a lot of money. They, you know, they have to think things through in a very thorough way.
And on top of that, and this is I really do believe this, and I have taught a bit at a few universities, arts administration, principals and that sort of thing. And in some ways, not-for-profit work is much more challenging and complicated than working in the for-profit or corporate sector, because in the corporate or for-profit world, it's very easy to know whether you are succeeding or not, or if the job
measure is very clear.
It's maximization of profit, return on investment. But in the not-for-profit world, it is much more complicated what success is and looks like, how you measure what you're doing, and what it means to succeed or not is a far more complicated thing.
It's true.
Organizations, they all don't even have the same vision of what the mission is in the first place, and that is extraordinarily difficult to do.
I find it inspiring. I just do, and I love Cage. I quote Cage all the time, but one of the things he used to say is, "Oh, Laura, we never let the economic impediment stand in our way."
Exactly.
Pisses people off sometimes when I say that, because it's like, well, how are we supposed to do this? I don't know. That's the challenge, that is the challenge.
So I saw an opening at the Library of the Performing Arts as deputy director. This is back in 2016, 15, 17.
I think it was 17, actually.
17. Yep. it to me seemed like the perfect place to sort of to take everything and move, but more to the point of this conversation, I knew that library well because I had spent time with the manuscript collection there. I had come to look at a few different pieces and other resources throughout my years in grad school and thereafter, as I was doing some research and doing thinking. And the idea of going to work at the institution that's entrusted with the manuscript collections of so many of the most fundamentally important composers and thinkers in my own intellectual upbringing, including Cage, was this sort of awe-inspiring opportunity. And so I jumped at the chance.
Great, great. Who did you work with? Who was your senior?
It was Jackie Davis. She was director.
Oh, Jackie. Yeah, sure. Yeah. So you didn't work with George Boswick at all?
When I was there, so I came in and part of my job was being a director, managing the curators. And so I overlapped with George just for a few months,
maybe
8 or 9 months, but he was moving towards retirement when I arrived, which was
I see. Not
some time with him, but not nearly enough time.
Yeah. He was very special.
Oh God, absolutely.
It doesn't feel like it was that long ago that he retired, but of course it was.
In library time, it really wasn't. We've been around 127 years, so.
Right. It's a blink of an eye for them.
he is really built and incredible.
Are you in touch with him at all? Is he in touch with the library at all?
He's definitely in touch with the library. I've been in touch a little bit here and there.
Uh-huh.
The new music curator definitely, and the leadership there is in touch with him. And of course, there are still occasionally questions that come up that only he can answer, because the answer is somewhere in his brain.
Uh-huh. I hope you'll say hello for me the next time you speak. He and I, we weren't close friends, but we were close colleagues, He was an important character for me in this, the beginning of our relationship with the New York Public Library, as was Gene Bowen, who's probably retired. Did you know Gene at all?
Met, but, long retired before I got there. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, she went to 42nd Street. You're positioned at Lincoln Center, are you not?
So I'm down at 42nd Street.
Oh, you are at 42nd Street. Oh, yeah. Well, that's where she went. Okay. So you graduated from college. You worked for AEA for a while. And then you came to NYPL. But you did other things. You played, you're an amateur pianist. I know that.
I've earned money from it occasionally, but never seriously.
Okay.
Your money in college. It was closest to my profession then. But I played in grad school and in undergrad. Yeah. Mostly jazz piano, some concert piano. My only non-jazz performance on a real stage was performing four with Rob Haskins, and I'm trying to remember who else, in Merkin Hall here in New York.
That was four something, right?
Completely forgetting who the other two of the four were, which is a shame.
One of them is a woman.
Yes.
I'm trying to remember her name. Yeah, I can see the CD in my head, actually. I had a piano, my composition teacher when I was in college, undergrad, where I went to Dominican College in Northern California, His name was Jules. I'm going to block his last name. But anyway, the point is about playing the piano. His son was taking piano lessons. And he was sharing with the class one day that he was so angry with his wife because his son hated practicing the piano. And so she started to pay him a quarter an hour to practice. And it just infuriated him. And I said something rather high toned, you know, I said, "Oh, is that because you want him to feel his own motivation to play?" And he said, "No, for heaven's sakes, I just didn't want him growing up thinking that anyone was going to pay him to do this."
Yeah, I saw the lack of economic possibility as a performer and went into music history.
right. My father was a pianist, but he could never make a living at it, so he ended up a businessman. But so when I went into music, he was both in awe and irritated, you know, both. No, that song from Sondheim, "Work is what you do for others, baby. Art is what you do for yourself." Yes. That's the line from Sunday in the Park with George.
Yeah. But so, you know, I've been at the library for a while now, and I, Jackie, who we were just talking about, she retired a little while after I got to the library. I stepped in as the interim director there for a bit. And I moved on, and in 2019, I ended up taking over a new team that was focused on the digital side of the research libraries.
Right. I'm very, very interested in spending time with you on about that, on that subject, because it's, I mean, it's such a critical thing right now for everybody.
Yeah. So I did that work. I started that new post, and it was a newly formed division, basically at the start of 2020. It was actually, I think, towards the end of February of 2020, I gave a presentation to our board of trustees in which I discussed the importance of remote access to resources and our need to invest in them.
Well, you were prophetic, or you caused COVID. One of those two things.
Prophetic, but it was an extremely rewarding role to be in during the pandemic.
I'm sure. I mean, everybody was, you know, so much so isolated from the public. So if you were in a position such as you were, which was dedicated to the public, you had to make things up a lot for, you know, your own gratitude and your own self-worth, all of that.
Our staff improvised a lot and did a lot of creative things to get all of the researchers and performers and others who rely on us what they needed.
Yeah, I think you had to reassure yourself constantly that it wasn't going to be like this forever, and that you should be using this time to work out programs and processes and skills that you never really had time to work on, you know, because you were constantly being asked questions by somebody who needed you to help them. So there you were, you know, you were in a perfect position, actually, at that moment.
And it was, you know, it's one thing that was the strangest about that time, but it was interesting to think about is, I think something that has been extraordinarily useful to me throughout my career. I go back to that, you know, Larry Polansky seminar, and back to my first encounter with Cage, is shutting up and listening and putting, you know, listening to things and framing them as music, sort of just stepping back and sort of, you know, taking in the landscape just with ears in a way that I'd never had done before. I encountered Cage and started reading Silence and everything else. The pandemic, especially in the city, for those of us who live here, was in some ways an extraordinarily and strangely beautiful time, despite being horrifying and terrifying, because you would walk around Manhattan and sounded so different than it ever had before.
Right.
And you think of you know, some of the interviews, you know, things captured on video with Cage, in which the, you know, the car horns interrupt, and that's the point. I can only imagine what he would have thought if he were alive during the pandemic and got to experience the city in an entirely new way.
Exactly. You know, and not so long before that COVID happened, we made an app for the Cage Trust. It's a 433 app. So you probably used it or have seen it at least.
I know. Well.
And people wrote about it, you know, in the most beautiful way. They just said, you know, you can't go to concerts, you can't do this, you can't do that, but there's this app, you know, that can transport you to any place in the world. You know, you can't travel, but you can do it this way. It was really beautiful. We felt very, very lucky, because we were not prophetic. You know, we just wanted to we wanted to make an app. Anyway, so you've been at the library since then?
Since then. And as of January, I'm now in charge of all of the research libraries.
I know. I can't imagine how horribly big that job is.
I'm still struggling to wrap my brain around it.
Well, what does that mean to be in charge of the four libraries? So you oversee the staff in all four locations.
So New York Public Library is a very large and complicated organization in a very good way. So we are the largest public library system in the world. So we have close to 90 locations across the Bronx, Manhattan, and Staten Island. Libraries, you know, go in, take things home, use computers, get classes, you know, have all sorts of public engagement. And in addition to that, and I don't have anything to do with the sort of the branch system, except for the fact that the Library of the Performing Arts is a circulating library. You can take home scores and music biographies and books and other things. We also have a set of research libraries that go back, and it was the research libraries that were the collections at the founding of the libraries in the late 19th century, that together steward a collection of about 45 million objects and growing, depending on how you count it. In three locations, so so we have the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture in Harlem. That is the most eminent institution devoted to the study of Black lives in the world. We have the Library of the Performing Arts at Lincoln Center, which we've been talking about, which is our music, theater, and dance archive and recorded sound archive. Here at 42nd Street is archive and set of collections on the humanities and social sciences. And then there is a science, industry, and business library as well. We oversee the collection to that. And then on the branch side in our newly renovated flagship across the street is a whole business center that has, you know, support for entrepreneurs and other sorts of things. I don't directly oversee that team, but
Thank God. Of course, I'm seeing you like frosting on a cake, getting more and more spread, thinner and thinner.
Yeah, we also have a state-of-the-art conservation and preservation laboratory in Queens, where we do all of our work conserving items, digitization work, preservation work, cataloging work, processing work, and so forth. So together, we're about 500 staff or so, depending on how you count it. And we have, you know, a few million visitors a year that come to use our reading rooms or to our exhibitions or to our public programs and so on.
You have an exhibition up right now, I think, with some Cage in it.
Oh yeah, absolutely. So we
Bacchanal is in it, I think. It's Bacchanal.
Yes, I think it's just about a permanent little Cage nook. So one thing we're very proud of is we just opened in I think it was meant to open the pandemic, but it opened in 20. I think it was meant to open in 2020, but I might have the date wrong. It opened in 2021. Exhibition called Treasures. We have, among, as you can imagine, the 45 million items, some real gems. They're kind of all gems, but the point of this exhibit is to bring together in one room a couple hundred of the most extraordinary items that we have, around nine themes. We actually rotate items in the exhibit, despite it being a permanent collection, every, you know, 3 months or so. So it is constantly changing.
It is a kind of permanent installation?
It is permanent. I think it's funded for 75 years to start. So.
That's so great. That's so great. See what COVID's done? I haven't been there. It's been 4 years since I've been there.
Anyone can come down. It's free and open to the public. And one of the corners of the exhibit is focused on performances. And so we have, in one case, Bacchanal, a piece from one of the manuscript pages from it. I think on the flip side of that vitrine is a section from Beethoven's Archduke Trio in his hand. Mozart's, I think it's his 30th symphony. I'm probably getting that wrong. Amazing photograph of Sonny Rollins. I mean, it's just, I think we've had some Bob Dylan for a while. It's an incredible
nice.
Of the items in our collection. Lou Reed is in there right now as well. We steward his collection.
That show was beautiful, the Lou Reed show that they did.
It was. For those who missed it, I'm very sorry. But
it was so good. So good. You know what else was really good? It was the George Avakian. Mm-hmm. Did you see that? The George Avakian, that Jonathan Haim did that one.
That sadly was, I believe, before my time, unless I'm misremembering.
It could be. I see things in two ways, pre-COVID and post-COVID. And this was definitely pre-COVID.
might have been pre-me at the library, at least, but definitely was pre-COVID.
Yeah. Anyway, it was really, really good. Bakhtiam, for people who don't know, was an early sound recording person, produced a lot of materials that were released later by such places as the Smithsonian Folkways label and things like that. And anyway, they acquired his archive.
One exhibit we did, which was maybe one of the more meaningful ones for me along the way, this was also a Jonathan Heim, and Jessica Wood, the assistant curator, was involved as well. But it was, it was also, I'm going to misremember his name. It'll come to me in just Seth Kluett. Seth Kluett was a curator as well. Columbia University. But it was an exhibit focused on our history of electronic music, which is extraordinarily strong. So, mm-hmm. Perez, it was Pauline Oliveris, Otto Luning, Charles Dodge, among others. Charles was one of my composition teachers at college, and he came down for the reception, and I had not seen him since I was
in college. Since you were a wee lad.
We have extraordinary peeks into the collection across the centers.
Lovely, lovely. I'm so glad. I'm so happy to hear that. You also have something that I've never experienced firsthand, and you have a new outdoor garden. You do things in this outdoor space.
So it's so funny. Our terrace or our porch or whatever you want to call it. So for those who know the building, there's this beautiful terrace on the western side of the library. If you don't know the library, but you've been to Lincoln Center Theater, they're the same building, the library wrapped around the theater. There's this beautiful terrace behind the building that had never really been used before because there isn't to date a real proper exit or entrance. You kind of have to go along the side and sort of snake along to get there. But it's beautiful and rather poignant because you could fit dozens and dozens of people there, and above you is the overhang of the building. And that overhang is actually the stacks on the third floor where our collections reside. And so you're sitting in this outdoor space, and above you are the stacks where manuscripts and cage manuscripts and other things reside, because they're either up there or they're down in the basement or the two main storage areas.
Right, right. Is it protected? So can you have musicians playing instruments? It's covered enough to be...
Yeah, we've had story times there for kids. We've had performances. We've had other things. Right. In a beta phase, just 2 years in, we started it. Of course, it was something that made sense. It suddenly made sense to pursue during the pandemic because there was no proper outside space for the library. And we thought, well, gosh, let's figure out how to make this make sense and pursue it.
That's right. That's right. And all of a sudden you have a space that has, air circulating.
Exactly. And so we're hoping to do more of the space going forward, but it is a really beautiful little gem.
I can't wait to visit. I just can't wait.
Yeah. Anyone listening is welcome. Please. It's one of the reasons I wanted to work at this institution. It's not just the fact that it's, John Cage and Meredith Monk and Lou Reed sitting on these stacks next to each other. I love all of the archives of the world. We were talking about Northwestern and a few other, but what makes New York Public Library so special is we're not a university. We're not a government. We're an independent, not-for-profit. And anyone is allowed access to the collections. You don't have to be a professor or a student. You have to be a library card holder, and you can come in the meeting room and get access to our things. And that to me is very beautiful and very important.
Yeah. Going back to soccer, when I was sort of interviewing them for the possible placement of the manuscript collection, which ended up not there, but part of that process led us into conversation about, they wanted to know who, I said, so this is a public institution? No, it wasn't. He's a private collector. I said, and how does that affect, who has access? And they said, well, who are you thinking? And I said, I'm not sure. I said, I didn't think that I would have to ask this question. And I was starting to talk about the different kinds of people that might want access to a music manuscript collection of the likes of John Cage, And I said, performers, I said historians, of course, and academics, of course, but also performers. And they went, no, performers, no.
No, and I think that's an area where we have had some success. It is important, but it's a huge area of growth and focus going forward, which is, anyone who is at the beginning of their career, middle or end, and is a composer, is a creator, is a poet, is any kind of doer, thinker, maker, these are your raw materials. But I think there are many people who think that institutions like ours are only meant for PhDs writing books and dissertations, and they aren't allowed in otherwise. And we need to constantly do work to invite people in and make sure they understand, you know, our resources, which we take care of for them, are theirs, and they under them and use them appropriately.
Right.
Legally, but that's the whole point.
Yeah. I began to, you know, sort of see institutions like NYPL, like Soccer, like Bard, whatever, you know, any place that houses original materials, you know, you begin to see them in terms of if you had something of value and you wanted to place it there, you know, what are the criteria that you're looking for to place, you know, to place it somewhere? You know, it's economic return, it's safety, it's access, it's all those things. And they're all different. You know, all the institutions prioritize differently.
Oh, absolutely. We sometimes, I'd say some of our best work is sending people to other institutions, the Library of Congress, the Ransom Center, or elsewhere, because their collection may actually make more sense for another institution because of what they have and what they steward. But if you're, you know, 20th century American modernism onward, you know, we're the place for it.
Exactly. You acquire, and it also seems to me every time I talk to somebody at NYPL in your position or around your position, you guys acquire so much stuff. It's such an active process of acquisitions. You acquired Michael Rouse, who has been a really, really close friend for decades. And
earlier today.
You did? That's so great. That's so sweet. That's so sweet.
Actually, I think we're having an, because he has is organized an addition to his archive. So I think
that's, of course he is. Endlessly.
One of the most organized composers in our collection, I think. Which we deeply love him for.
He'll laugh. It's okay. We can talk about him behind his back.
we collect, so it's, you know, this is gonna sound like technical jargon, but I kind of love it. We collect more than 1,000 linear feet of items every year. Linear feet is literally, you know, the stuff that fits in a foot long banker's box.
Yes, of course. No, I know. I know.
You know, we collect about 1,000 or more across our institutions every year. And some are small, you know, collections, a few boxes here or there of an eminent, important person. Others are, you know, massive collections that become tentpoles for the institution. The Cage Manuscript Archive is obviously one of those. Most recently, we just announced and shared to the public an incredible theater archive. George C. Wolfe came to us, which we're deeply excited about. Earlier, uh-huh. We also acquired Joan Didion and John Gregory Dunn's paper, which we're currently processing. It'll be ready in a couple years for the public. So, you know, but what I find sort of deeply and philosophically moving about the act of collecting at this sort of pace and for this institution. And to me, it's a kind of optimistic nihilism, I refer to it, which is our job is impossible. We are a space with finite resources that is collecting lots of stuff. And our promise to the public is that we are going to keep that stuff safe until the end of time and never get rid of it. We're the forever place. Nothing ever leaves our grasp. Once we've said we will take it in, it is a sacred pact with the public that says we will take care of this.
No deaccession clause.
There's a deaccession policy for us and other institutions like ours, but it is a very strict policy, and it really has to do with, is something, you know, dangerous because it's a film that's degrading and, you know, releasing toxic gases or things like that.
Right.
Very small. It's a very small part of the reality of what happens here. But yeah. So, you know, we are collecting miles of material a year, and a passage that I often refer to because I think it's a perfect example is from Kurt Vonnegut's second book, Sirens of Titan, and he, very typical Kurt Vonnegut sci-fi, someone is trapped oscillating between past, present, and future. And at one point, he comes back from 10 million years in the future, or maybe it's someone purports to have heard him talk about it. And he gives an interview and says that in the year 10 million AD, all of the archives and libraries of the world took the first million years of history they were stewarding and burned it at the dump because libraries and archives were crowding the living off Earth. Forward, all the history books referred to that period as in the first million years after the death of Jesus Christ, there's a general period of readjustment. I don't know that we're ever going to get to that place, but we are severely resource and space challenged, the entire field.
But that, you know, that makes the digitization business that we just barely touched on so critical. You know, it's, we need to think about this stuff. We need to think about that.
But on the other hand, even more challenging in a way too. So, and Cage was just, you know, on the cusp of this, but it's all the composers who followed who are there, which is, instead of having big manuscript archives now, you might have thousands of Finale and Sibelius and other files. But if we want to provide access to a composer's work 30 years later, we need to have backwards compatibility for every version of a software that existed.
Yeah, yeah.
We have right now in our stacks dozens and dozens and dozens of terabytes of Lou Reed's Ableton and Pro Tools. And, you know, we can provide the files, but to provide compatibility to all of those software types is something that we're just at the very beginning of figuring out and being able to provide that access, because.
But talk about the impossibility, Brent, you know, the impossibility, because you don't know what the formats of the future are. You don't know what the what is compatibility, compatibility with the unknown.
You know, I just be expensive.
Talk about a science fiction novel.
And then here's the last thing I'll add, which makes it even more beautiful, but also challenging. So I spent a lot of time working on, my dissertation was on, I got interested in politics and music history. And so I ended up writing my dissertation on John F. Kennedy's administration and how they got into the business of wanting to fund the arts and what led that decision-making process. So I spent some time in the Kennedy archive. It's 40 million documents, roughly, I believe, 30 or 40 million. That's the same size as the Johnson presidential archive. And Bob Carrow is just hopefully finishing up his biography of Johnson. And it's taking him decades to do that work because he's looking at every single document, turning every page, as he famously says. I spent a little bit of time with the Obama Foundation, and the archive for Obama is 1 billion documents, 95% are digital.
Wow.
And what's amazing is we can save so much more when it's digital because you don't have to throw it away.
Yeah.
But the scale of what we can collect from the cages of the future is so large that it is baffling to human understanding of how you'll make sense, how you'll sift through the boxes. And that we haven't figured out either.
That's okay. That's okay. You have time. You have time. And it's good that you're only 20 because, you know, you have all this time ahead of you.
And most importantly, the other thing I'd like to say, and this goes back to the optimistic nihilism, if I do my job well, I don't matter. And by that, I mean, we're supposed to take care of this stuff for thousands of years. So the someone who's here for a decade or two and does good work should be a very small part of a very long story.
Right. It's a very long story and a very, very long thought process.
Yes.
You're just adding yours right now.
Yes. So I'm hoping to be a footnote in a long history.
I can assure you that that will be the case. All right, Brent, we have to stop. Believe it or not, we've been talking for just shy of 50 minutes, 50. I could talk to you for hours. Can we have lunch sometime?
I would love that.
Okay, good. I'll holler at you. I'm in the city like about once a month. I come into the city.
I'll walk you around the exhibit and take you. One of our fun secrets is, because it's not really open to the public too much, but I'll take you down. We have two floors of storage underneath Bryant Park. As well.
Really? Cool. Okay. I'm going to hold you to that. All right. We're going to be playing some music that Brent chose, a Cage piece called Dream. I'll be putting that on the program. I'll let you know after we hang up, after we stop this conversation. I will let you know, Brent, as soon as I know. It's possible that it will air on Saturday. So I'll send you the link. You can distribute it as you wish. And I hope you like us.
Thank you.
It was fun. Thank you so much, Brent. Thank you for all the work you do.
No, absolutely. And you as well.
Thank you. Bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Now on to Cage's Dream from 1948, Reedy's music selection for this week, as performed by Stephen Drury on the Catalyst BMG Classics CD label, entitled John Cage in a Landscape from 1994. Enjoy. Thank you.
preceding show was recorded at Wave Farms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.